The purpose of our studying the life of Christ out of this gospel for a few weeks is for the purpose of lifting up Jesus Christ so that he might, having been lifted up, draw all of us to himself. And he's promised that he'll do that. And I have confidence in the gospel that it will do precisely that. I'm counting on you now to read these chapters each week as we approach them and try to delve into them and discern the message. It's going to take your work and mine if we make a very good attempt at seeing the Lord in these beautiful pictures that John draws of the life of Christ and the settings and all. So if you will, join with me during the week or on Sunday afternoon and prepare your mind as you read these accounts in John's Gospel. May God bless us tonight while we study about him. Last Sunday night, we left the Lord in the city of Sychar down in Samaria with Samaritans around him, listening to him and being drawn toward him to worship him and to come to know his Father. However, after the 2 days were completed, he left Samaria and went on down into Cana of Galilee, where he had first turned the water to wine, and spent some time there and went on to Capernaum and spent some more time there. And then, with the approaching of this unnamed feast, the one that is in chapter 5, it's called the unnamed feast, with the approaching of this feast, Jesus once more made his way up to the city of Jerusalem in order to keep the feast and to project his personal ministry along the projected timetable that he had set for his revealing of himself to the people. And with the return of Jesus Christ to Jerusalem in chapter 5, those simple, uncomplicated months of his early ministry were to be brought to a sudden end. Never to go back was he to those simple days, to the domestic scenes, the pastoral scenes, the uncomplicated scenes of consideration where people were congenial and were simply looking at him and getting to know him. Those days were to be now ceased forever. You remember when we first saw him, he was walking down a path or a road down toward the Jordan River, toward John the Baptist and some of John's disciples. And John pointed to him one day and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." The next day we find the same or similar scene, and John points and says, "The Lamb of God," again. And Andrew and another disciple followed Jesus and went home with him that day and spent the afternoon. It was about 4 o'clock. And they sat there and discerned and came to the conclusion that this man must be the Messiah. And the next day, it seems, they went out and Andrew told Peter, and the other disciple probably went and told someone. They came out and said, "Eureka, the Messiah, we found him." And then we find those simple scenes being added to when he went to the wedding in Cana and was happy to accept an invitation to come and bless that house with his presence at a wedding feast, and saved the day, incidentally, by turning the water to wine, and aligned himself with the common folk and associated himself on that occasion with the servants at the house and let them in on a secret. You remember how he was willing to do that and not to take the glory for himself, but let the bridegroom have the glory. And then we saw him as he went into the temple in Jerusalem and turned over the money changers' table, drove out the oxen and the cattle, and turned over the tables and the money changers' money went rolling. And we saw a different side of the Lord as he drew there and was willing to draw a line of demarcation between right and wrong. And as he said, "It's time that you understood some things. And you're not going to make my Father's house a house or a den of robbers." We saw a very different side of him, though it was the same side or the same Lord. It was a different side of the coin. And the time had come to set his foot down, and he had the authority to do it. And nobody resisted him, though they questioned him a bit, but they didn't resist him. They knew he was right. And then Nicodemus, I think, on that same trip that Jesus made to Jerusalem, Nicodemus came one night and was amazed and awed by the uncompromising demand of the Lord that you be born anew, that you be born again of water and the Spirit, and that this new birth is absolutely essential to to entrance into the kingdom of God. Well, after Jesus Christ had talked with Nicodemus, as he saw the storm clouds gathering on the horizon and heard the rumblings of discontent among the Jewish leaders, not being willing at that time to have a confrontation with them or a showdown, he left, went into Samaria, and spent a few more days of peace and quiet among people that would listen to him, and then went on down into Galilee, and then came on back to Jerusalem, and that's where we find him at the fifth chapter at this particular time. But the days of simplicity and congeniality were gone. And the Lord now, in this chapter, drives a wedge. And I think you can say that it was the first permanent wedge. Oh, the cleansing of the temple was a shock treatment. He more or less got their attention, but he was in and out and gone, and they didn't quite know what had hit them. And he was away again, and they didn't have a chance to get at him permanently. But with the coming of chapter 5, there was a determined, unrelenting setting forth of his claim, upon which he demanded their allegiance and demanded their service and their honoring him as Lord. And he never let up from that day until the time that he was crucified. And then even after that, his claims after his death even. The Jewish people at the time that Jesus Christ went to Jerusalem on this occasion, the Jewish people, their mind was already set. Their mind was already closed. They didn't want to be confused with the evidence. They didn't want to be confused with the truth. They had already made up their minds, and Jesus Christ knew it, and he took charge of the situation. But they were merely looking for an excuse by which to judge him and bring him into condemnation. And they found their excuse in the occasion of the healing of this lame man at the pool of Bethesda, or Bethzatha, or Bethsaida, it's called. We find those three words also applying to this pool. But nevertheless, the healing at the pool of Bethesda provided this opportunity for the Jews to condemn Jesus. It was a Saturday. Might know it. Some of the most interesting things in Jesus' life took place on Saturdays, on the Sabbath. But Jesus went to the pool of Bethesda and saw this man among other people. They were blind and lame and paralyzed, the record says. And Jesus saw this man lying there who had been lame for 38 years. 38 years. That's all of my life. 38 long years this man had been lame. And he was lying there, and Jesus saw him and no doubt was moved to compassion and said, "Do you want to be made well?" And the man said, "Well, sir, I don't have anybody to put me in the water." And when the troubling of the water, and there was this tradition that when the water was troubled and by some action, they had the tradition among the Jews that it was the angel stirring the water. And he said, "Sir, when this water is troubled, I don't have anybody to put me in the pool. And while I'm trying to get there, somebody else gets down there and goes in before me." And it's pathetic. It's a very pathetic. I guess he's having pity upon himself, but he was just simply relating what had happened over and over and over again. He just hadn't been successful on getting there, and nobody seemed to care whether he got there or not. So Jesus said, "Take up your pallet and walk." The man took up his pallet. He was strengthened. He sensed the feeling in his body that he had been healed. He took up the pallet and he began to walk. What a wonderful occasion that was. Such an occasion, no doubt, that caused such confusion and joy and happiness in that little community of people. They had come there and had gotten to know each other. They were regulars there. And among the regulars that were there, this man's healing no doubt stirred a great interest. And they were no doubt happy and rejoicing with him. And then here came the authorities and said, "Just a moment, stop that man." And said, "It's the Sabbath day. You're not supposed to be carrying your pallet." The man said, "Well, the man that healed me told me to pick up my pallet." And they said, "Oh, who was it that said this to you, to pick up your pallet and walk?" And he said, "I don't know." Because Jesus, whenever he had healed the man, he just stepped back into the background, as he often had. And so the man said, "I don't know who it was." Well, they let him go. We find him, it says next, in the temple. The temple is just about a good stone's throw from the pool of Bethesda right today. You can go there and see it. And it wouldn't take you 5 minutes to walk there. And a man that had been healed after 38 years, it didn't take him but just that long. He's there just up and down. He's already there. So the man went there, no doubt, to offer praise to God and thanksgiving. And Jesus, it says, found him there and said, "See, you've been made whole. Don't you sin anymore now, lest the worst thing come on you." And Jesus Then, having said that, the man went away and told the authorities that it was Jesus who had healed him. Why he didn't know Jesus when he first saw him, I don't know. But he didn't. But the man went away and told the authorities that it was Jesus who had healed him. Now, several things, and I'm not going to have time to go into detail on any of this, really. But Jesus must have done this as an intentional effort to confront the Jewish people. I don't believe that he just happened to bump into the man and say, "Oh, here you are again." I think he looked for him. It says Jesus found him. Intentionally, I think it implies. And Jesus found him knowing full well that this man was going to go to the authorities. Jesus knew what was in every man, John had already told us. And he knew that this man was going to go to the authorities and tell them it was Jesus that did it. And I don't think the man did it with any malice in his heart. Maybe he did it to get himself off the hook. This man had been charged, you see, with violating the Sabbath day. His only justification or his only excuse for doing it was that this man who had enough power and authority to heal me, he's the one that told me to do it. And that's my only clearing of myself. And so perhaps it was in response to their accusation against him that he went immediately to them and said, "There's the man that did it. It's Jesus of Nazareth." No doubt Jesus knew that he was going to do it. And Jesus did it anyway. Which leads us to the conclusion, as you'll see all down through this chapter, that Jesus Christ, after all, was in charge of the whole business. He never was under the circumstances. You hear people talk about how you're doing today. Well, under the circumstances, I'm all right. Jesus was never under the circumstances. He was never the victim of the circumstances. He was always the one in charge of everything that was going on round about him. And this is just simply to add to what he said, "I am laying down my life. Nobody is taking it away from me." And there's a man in England who has written several books. Oh, I forget his name just off. I had it a few moments ago. But anyway, I'll think of it in a moment. But he wrote a book, and in the book he talked about how that Jesus Christ actually, it seems, ordered his own death. This man is a Jew. What's his name? He's not even a believer in Christ. But he is intrigued enough about Jesus Christ that he did a long, prolonged study into the life of Jesus. And he came to this conclusion. After studying the life of Jesus Christ, he concluded that he believed Jesus Christ actually arranged for his own death. And I laugh every time I read or every time I think about having read what this Jew said, because he had gotten deep enough into the Gospels to sense that Jesus Christ himself was in charge of all the circumstances that were happening. So here, as he had been at least at first reluctant to let his hour begin to start or begin to happen at the wedding of Cana, he said, "My hour has not yet come. This was not the time when I had determined to begin showing myself to the people." Here, Jesus Christ went out of his way to confront the Jewish people, having provided this event happening on the Sabbath day, then having almost let it slip out of his grasp, it seemed, as he stepped back into the background. Then he went and found the man again, knowing full well, I do not doubt, but what the man would go to the authorities and say it was Jesus of Nazareth. And so when they came and accused Jesus, Jesus then offered this defense. He said, "My Father is working still, and I am working." And in this fifth chapter, we find Jesus Christ being put on trial. Whenever Jesus Christ was accused of violating the Sabbath day, he simply said, "I am working, and my Father is working still, and I am working. I'm doing the same thing my Father did." And then in verse 17, 18, it says this. This was why the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but he also called God his Father, making himself equal with God. In this verse here, there are two verbs that are used that are imperfect verbs, which means that there was an open-ended thing, really, that it was something that was repeatedly done over and over and over again. And when you go into the Gospels and you check into the life of Christ, they were right. Jesus was forever doing something like this on the Sabbath day. And their charge against him was correct. He was always doing it. He was repeatedly breaking the Sabbath day. And the other verb where it says they also condemned him because of the fact that he called God his Father, that's also an imperfect verb, which means that he was forever calling God his Father. He was always repeatedly calling God his Father. And when you check through the Scriptures, you find that is precisely what was happening. That is precisely what he went about doing. He was forever breaking the Sabbath, and he was forever calling God his Father. So they pegged him properly. They accused him properly and persecuted him, however, for the wrong reasons. But nevertheless, they properly identified him, and they found the excuse that they wanted, as Jesus Christ provided them this opportunity at the healing of the Pool of Bethesda. Now, in chapter 5, let's back off just a bit and see it in its proper perspective. In chapter 5, you see a preliminary trial. And I've come to see this week that also not only in chapter 5, but in chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11, chapter 12, chapter 18, and chapter 19, you have about 8 trials, all of them preliminary but one, and every one of them providing the accused, Jesus Christ, with the charges, with the defense that he makes, with the evidence and the witnesses that he brings up as his substantiating witnesses or evidence, and then the verdict of the jury, the verdict of the people, as they said, we don't want him, condemn him, and they thumbed him down. And we find that that's happening here in the 5th chapter of John also. All right, Jesus' defense was, and no doubt this must have originated with Jesus, the best defense is a good offense. And I'm telling you what, like I said a moment ago, Jesus Christ was never on the defensive. He always seized the initiative. He always was the one who was in charge of the circumstances and let it be known that he was the one that was directing things. Never did he allow the opposition party, to seize the initiative. In this particular claim that Jesus makes, my Father is working still and I'm working, Jesus Christ drives this first wedge. Here was the first of a prolonged, continuous assault, a prolonged, continuous driving of this wedge that separated Jesus Christ from the unbelieving Jews. And when Jesus Christ said, my Father is still working and I am working, they got the message. They knew what he was talking about. The Jew had a hang-up about the Sabbath. The Jew had read in the law of Moses that God rested upon the Sabbath from his creation, and they had drawn all sorts of erroneous conclusions. They had drawn all sorts of conclusions that were wrong and had bound these false conclusions upon the people. For example, they just simply meant that they made it so that you couldn't do anything on the Sabbath day. You couldn't do hardly any act of kind. You couldn't do anything. Well, let's just leave it that way. They spent volume after volume after volume outlining what could be done and what could not be done on the Sabbath day. I find myself being driven to the conclusion that they, by their extra rules, the extra rules that they drew up, they defeated the very purpose for which the Lord had set the Sabbath aside anyway. Jesus is saying here, and the rabbis, many of them had come to the conclusion that though God had rested from his creation work, that though God had rested on the Sabbath day from creating, he didn't rest from doing good. He didn't rest from the rain being sent upon the just and the unjust. He didn't cause the sun to stop shining. One of the rabbis said, the rivers keep flowing, the sun keeps shining, the rain keeps falling. God hasn't stopped his acts of kindness to men. He hasn't stopped his sustaining of the human race. He hasn't stopped the world from continuing in its orbit. All of these things are God working. That's what all this is about. And Jesus just simply said, that's all I'm doing. And they got his message. They said not only did he break the Sabbath, but he called God his Father. And there's a word, though, in the Greek text that doesn't appear in the American, in the English translation. And it's the word idion, which means simply he called God his own Father. And that's more than just a simple possessive. It simply means that he sorted himself out and separated himself from the other people and said, God is my Father, in contrast to God being their Father. He was saying that God was his own Father in a peculiar sense that these other people didn't enjoy. And this just literally infuriated these people. But notice, if you will, in verses 19 and 20, Jesus uses a very beautiful, local, colorful example of what he's talking about. And he picked out of their own society a custom that was so fully understood by them and made it applicable to himself that not a single Jew of those there misunderstood what he was talking about. He described his relationship to God as one of being a son being apprenticed out to his father's work. Listen to this, if you will. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever he does, the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. And greater works than these will he show him, that you may marvel. What Jesus did was simply this. He drew from an experience with which they were familiar, this experience of the apprenticeship program among the Jewish people. It was completely, almost universally widespread among the Jews. Their whole economy was based upon this apprenticeship program, where a father took his son and lovingly taught him all of his own abilities and his own talents. If he was a carpenter or a stonemason or whatever it may have been, the father would take this son, and he said, and Jesus said, the son can't do anything on his own. And they knew that. They themselves had been apprentices, or they themselves had had sons that they had brought into their workshop and said, now, son, you watch me, and then I'm going to show you how to do it. And these sons, he said, would watch, and all they could do is what they saw their father doing. And he said, the father simply does these things, and the son does the same thing after watching the father. And Jesus said, and the father loves the son. And he shows him all of these things. Why, and he just simply drew out of the hat all these beautiful illustrations using this one simple illustration of the apprenticeship, and says the son can't do anything on his own. Only what he sees the father doing will he practice, and he'll do these things. The father loves him. The father shows him all these things, and he's going to show him greater things than these so that you might marvel. And this thing that illustrated also infuriated, because there the illustration was so pointed. The illustration was so exact. The illustration was so without any... Well, just simply with no reservation, Jesus Christ was simply saying, I am just like you. I am now standing and watching my Father work, and I've seen what He's done, and my works are nothing more than doing what He's done. And He said, hold on to your hats. Something else better than this is coming so that you might marvel. And so we find Him using that very simple illustration of what He was doing. But the implications of this relationship were profound. After he had said, I'm only doing what the Father has taught me to do. I'm only doing what the Father has shown me. And I'm only doing what I've seen the Father doing. But then he took that sledgehammer, backed off away from that wedge, and as though it were, used every force within his body and drove that wedge of separation without any reservation, drove it as hard as he could when he drew some implications from this relationship between him and his Father. And here it is. Two times, in two different ways, or in two ways that are specific, in verses 21 and 22, Jesus Christ refers to two prerogatives that had always been God's and only God's. One prerogative was the raising of the dead. The other prerogative that belonged only to God was this thing of judgment. Jesus Christ, in verses 21 and 22, takes those things and says, they are mine. Listen, for as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom He will. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son. Now listen, there were no other more specific references to the power and the authority of God that the Jew was aware of than the prerogative of God to raise the dead and to pass judgment upon human beings. Jesus Christ shocked these Jewish people by saying, these two prerogatives that you've always attributed to God and only to God, I am henceforth telling you that they now belong to me. And I have life within myself, and I can give life to whom I please. And God the Father has given judgment into my hands, and He is not judging anymore. He has given judgment into me, unto my hands. It is I who will judge. Back in the Old Testament, in the book of Deuteronomy, the writer there records God is saying this, see now that I, even I, am He, and there is no God other than me. I kill and I make alive. And this claim was simply an exclusive claim that God made for Himself. And He said, there is no other God that can make alive but me. Jesus Christ came upon the scene, this Word become flesh, and He stands there without any reservation and simply says, I have that prerogative. I can make alive. God has given it to me. Well, the second thing He simply says was that God has given into my hand judgment. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. Oh, back in the Psalms, in Psalms 50, you find there the writer, whether it was David, I'm not sure, but in Psalms 50, I think it was, David there records God as saying this, the heavens declare His righteousness, for God Himself is judge. In 75th Psalm, in verse 7, a similar statement is made there concerning the fact that God alone is able to judge the sons of men. But it is God who executes judgment, putting down one and lifting up another. And then in Psalms 96, we find this statement, say among the nations, Jehovah reigns, or the Lord reigns. Yea, the world is established. It shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. For he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with his truth. That's verses 10 and verse 13 of Psalms 96. You see how he claims to have the prerogative. This is his right to judge, and it's nobody else's right. And yet here comes this preacher from the north, this itinerant ignoramus, as they would call him, because he had no formal training. And for him to have the audacity to stand up before these people, these rulers of the Jews, these teachers, these rabbis, and to say to these people, I am the one who gives life. I am the one who has been given the right to judge. No wonder they hated him. And then he simply placed out before them in a very loving way. He gave them an alternative. He said, you can either honor me, and in so honoring me, honor the Father, or you can reject me. But he said, I want you to understand that he that rejects me rejects God also who sent me. And he leaves no middle ground. And it ought to be observed by people today, there is no middle ground in coming to Jesus Christ. Nobody on earth would object to accepting Jesus Christ as a good man or as a prophet. There's not an insane man. There's not a lunatic. There's not an atheist. There's not anybody that would object to letting Jesus Christ be accepted as a good man or as a prophet or as a teacher. But Jesus won't let you accept him like that. He says, you either honor me and therefore honor my Father, or else you reject me and you reject my Father. And what you do to me, you do to my Father. This is what John mentioned in John the 20th chapter and verses 30 and 31, where John says many other things Jesus did in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. There is no middle ground. Anybody would be willing to delete from the gospel message the miracles of Christ. Anybody would be willing to delete from the gospel message the claims of Jesus Christ and leave this skeleton of somebody who doesn't even live, to leave this skeleton of this anemic nobody, this halfway in between and this nobody, this nothing. Anybody would allow that to be done, because that would remove his right to judge. It would remove his power to raise from the dead. And who can fear somebody who can't raise anybody from the dead? Who can fear anybody that doesn't have the right to judge? And so the world would be more than willing, but Jesus won't let it be done. And he said, you either accept me for what I'm claiming for myself, or you deny God. And he associated himself here inseparably with the God that these Jews claim to serve. And he said, let me tell you, your actions to me are the same as your actions to my Father, and what you do is a reflection of how you think toward my Father. Well, no wonder they hated him. Let me tell you, in this event, in this occasion here, Jesus Christ made more claims. He made as many claims, I think, in chapter 5. No, I can't say that, because you get to chapter 8 and chapter 7 and chapter 6 all through here. I'm going to count before we get through studying and find out how many claims Jesus Christ made for himself. And it's going to shock you. You're going to see that there was no question about their condemning him as an impostor, as someone that they said was guilty of blasphemy. But Jesus invites them to honor him or reject him, but warns them that to reject him is to reject God. But then not only did he take to himself these two prerogatives, that of raising the dead to life and that of judgment, but Jesus Christ on this occasion shocked these Jews still further, as though not to let well enough alone. Jesus not only said, I am the one who has the right to raise from the dead, and I am the one who has the right to judge, but Jesus simply says next, he said, you Jews, and let me paraphrase it and then I'll read it, he said, that which you have always accepted, and the Pharisees did accept the resurrection and the judgment. The Sadducees, there was some question about what they accepted. They didn't accept all the Pharisees did. But Jesus was saying here, essentially, what you have accepted as always being off in the future, that of the judgment and that of the raising of the dead and the coming judgment, he said, that which you have always relegated to some way off thing in the far, on the far off, he said, that is the very thing that has come about by my very coming to the earth. Now you're being raised from the dead, or now is the voice calling to raise people from the dead, and now is the judgment of the world. No doubt it must have shocked them to think of someone that would have the audacity to not only take these two prerogatives to himself, but then to say, not only that, but I'm telling you that by my very coming, and what I'm doing right now, is I am attempting to raise you from the dead spiritually. And I am now in the process of judging you, for the words that I'm speaking will judge you. Not only then, but they're judging you now. And Jesus Christ took this great prerogative to himself, and he talks about it as actually having begun when he came to the earth. In John, in this fifth chapter, he talks about two judgments here. He talks about the judgment that was now. The now is judgment. Listen, verse 25, truly, truly, I say to you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so has he granted the Son also to have life in himself. And he's given him authority to execute judgment, because He is the Son of Man. And here he talks about this now raising from the dead, that they were now hearing the voice of the Son of God. And he claimed that he was this Son of God, and that he had the power to raise people from the dead. Those that hear, he said, those who hear will live. And then he also said that God has granted to him this power to judge. That was one judgment, a spiritual judgment. Then in verse 28, he said, don't marvel at this, as though they were just shocked. He said, don't marvel at this. The hour is coming when all that are in the graves will hear his voice. And those that have done good will come forth to the resurrection of life, and those that have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. And he talked about the coming judgment. Not only is the judgment which is to come in the future going to come, he says it will. And there'll be a resurrection of the good and the bad. The good will be resurrected to life. The bad will be resurrected to judgment or condemnation. But he said that judgment has already begun. And you are now watching a preview of what's going to happen then. He says, I am the resurrection and the life, and I am the one who has the authority to judge. And then something, he threw this in just for good measure. He said, I am given this authority to judge because I am the Son of Man. And he used this very messianic expression that the Jew, it rung a bell with him immediately and called his mind back to the book of Daniel chapter 7, where there was stated, behold, the clouds of heaven, there came one likened to the Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. He says, I am that Son of Man. You can imagine the infuriation. You can imagine the resentment of these people as they stood there and listened to this man with obvious authority say, I am the one who raises the dead. I am the one who has judgment. I am the Son of God. I am the Father's Son. I am the Son of Man. But they rejected him. Oh, they listened. I don't think you could be around Jesus and not listen to him. But when the time came for the verdict in their heart, you know what it was? No, you're wrong. But, oh, our time is up. Jesus called forth, he called up some witnesses. He called John the Baptist. He said, you sent to John. He bore witness to the truth. John said, this is the Christ. He said, but I've got a greater witness than John. He said, the works that I've done in my Father's name, they bear witness to me. They wouldn't accept the reality of the works. They could not deny the reality, but they wouldn't accept the implement, the indication. They wouldn't accept the what these works indicated. In fact, they drew erroneous conclusions, began to say, oh, he's doing this by Beelzebub, the prince of demons. He's casting out demons and doing all these mighty works in the name of Beelzebub. And they were driven to conclusions that they couldn't even maintain under in any sense of the term. But then he said, also my Father's borne witness to me. He said, you haven't heard his voice at any time nor seen his form. And you don't have his word abiding in you because you don't accept him whom he sent. No doubt he may have referred here, I think, to the actual voice of God that was heard at the baptism of Jesus. Perhaps only John heard it in Jesus. Thou art my son, or this is my son, in whom I am well pleased. But he said, you wouldn't accept it. Then he said, you've rejected the scriptures. The scriptures, he said, bear witness to me. But you wouldn't accept the scriptures. In the verses 39 and 40, I think Jesus here referred to one thing, the final stroke, the final condemnation of these people, was that they searched the Scriptures, and yet, though the Scriptures were that which bore witness to Jesus, Jesus said, you have refused to come to me that you might have life. The Jews looked at the Scriptures like a monkey looks at a telescope. He looks at it and never through it. Very seldom would you find a monkey smart enough to look through a telescope and see what it was for, what it was designed for. All they would be content to do, they'd be content to just look at it and kind of munch around on it. And that's the way the Jews treated the Scriptures. I wish we had time to go into it, but we don't. But let me tell you something. And there are various countings of how many verses of Scripture, how many prophecies in the Old Testament referred to the coming of the Christ. But someone has concluded that there were 432 prophecies, at least 432 messianic prophecies, that were prophesied and given by the prophets of old concerning where he lived and where he was to be born and where he was to live and his work and his office and all these many myriads of things that the Messiah would be involved in. 432 of them. And yet the Jews missed every one of them. Harris J. Dark at David Lipscomb College some 25 years ago made a calculation of the estimated, what you would call the likelihood of Jesus Christ not being the Christ of the Old Testament. And he came to the conclusion after having done mathematical calculations, he said there's not one chance in 10,000 that Jesus of Nazareth was not the Jew, was not the Christ of the Old Testament Jewish scriptures. Not one chance in 10,000. And yet these people said, no, we reject you. Jesus gave three reasons. He said, you don't love God, you love the glory from men, and you don't even believe your own scriptures. And he said, because of that, you've rejected me. How can you believe me if you don't even believe Moses? How can you believe if you seek honor from man? And he said, you don't have the love of God in you. What an indictment against the Jewish people. What an indictment against their leaders, their rulers. John, in the 12th chapter, lamentingly said, though he had done so many signs before them, yet they did not believe. But this was that which Isaiah spoke of. Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore they could not believe, for Isaiah again said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they should see with their eyes, perceive with their heart, and turn for me to heal them. Isaiah said this because he saw his glory, and he spoke of him. Nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed on him, but for fear of the Pharisees they didn't confess it, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than they loved the praise of God. They didn't want anybody fooling with their lifestyle. They didn't want to change their way of living. What about you? Has he made any difference in your life? As you look back over your life, as long as you've known him, has he made any difference in the way you think? Has he made any difference in the way you live your life? Has he made you any cleaner in your thinking? Has he made you any more dedicated to good? Has he caused you to clean up your talk? Or are you still looking for glory from men? The boys in the locker room, had you still rather have their approval than to have the approval of God? I suspect that those of us who have seen that there's no difference made in our lives, I doubt that we have any more right to claim that we've accepted the Christ than these Jews back here who rejected him because they also love the praise of men more than they love the praise of God. So the trial closed. The accusations had been made. Jesus made his defense. He illustrated it. He then called for witnesses. He told what the repercussions of this thing, the implications of his association with his Father. He called for these witnesses, and then he charged them. You couldn't believe because you don't love God. You love the glory of men, and you don't even believe your own scriptures. May God bless.